Listening to Unsound Methods here on Yurt Radio from Hampshire College. I am Damon Blanchett, and each week on this show I talk science news and play some great music. At least I think so. If you'd like to reach me, you can do so during the show or any other time by tweeting to Damon Blanchett. That's all one word, DamonBlanchette. You can also send an email to damonblah@gmail.com, or you can find me on Facebook. This week's musical theme is pirates, as you might have guessed from that first song. That song at the top was from a band I have recently discovered by the name of Alestorm. Not only do I love the name of the band, but they're also pretty awesome. That song was called Over the Seas. Alestorm is a pirate metal band, the first that I've ever heard of. So every single one of their songs is about things that have to do with pirates. This wouldn't be amazing in and of itself, but they also happen to totally rock. I haven't listened to much other music than Alestorm for the past week, and I'm loving it. I've actually looked around, and I found two other pirate metal bands. One is called Swashbuckle, and the other one is Blackguard. Both of them are... amazingly, they're even heavier than Alestorm. A little too heavy, in my opinion. But still pretty good. All right, on to the science news. I realize that while I am, in fact, a computer scientist, I rarely have any computer science news on the show. So I'm going to start with a pretty good one here. I actually have a couple of computer stories this week. A new type of transistor that has a 4D shape resembling a pine tree has been invented. Well, it's actually 3D, but They're calling it 4D for some reason. Peter Yi, a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Purdue University, said, quote, "It's a preview of things to come in the semiconductor industry," end quote. Researchers from Purdue and Harvard universities created the new transistor, which is made not from silicon like current transistors, but a semiconductor material called indium gallium arsenide. You may be wondering about that 4D shape I mentioned a few moments ago. It has to do with speed and efficiency, along with heat dissipation. I'll let Professor Yi explain it. Quote, "A one-story house can hold so many people, but more floors, more people, and it's the same thing with transistors. Stacking them results in more current and much faster operation for high-speed computing. This adds a whole new dimension, so I call them 4D." End quote. Thank you, Professor Yi. Part of the reason this is so good is not only the new shape, but also because of the material they're using instead of silicon, which again is called indium gallium arsenide. And I actually just read an article about gallium recently. It's an interesting metal. It's shiny, it kind of looks like silver, but it has such a low melting point, which is about, I think it's 70-something Fahrenheit. So you could have a solid piece sitting in front of you on the table, and if you pick it up and put it in the palm of your hand, it will actually melt into a liquid right in your hand. It's just warm enough to melt it. It's kind of like chocolate. We could call it the chocolate metal. That's gallium again. It's a neat one. Computer scientists and engineers are reaching the limits of what silicon can handle without failing. And in addition, silicon has limited capacity for electrons to flow. So new materials such as this are a requirement if we are to continue increasing speed and efficiency of transistors, along with processors and everything else inside of a computer that uses silicon, which is most things. The material used in this research is one of a few that are being tested to replace silicon. Pretty cool. Processors in the next decade are going to go, in my opinion, really go through some major changes. It's a pretty exciting time to be in computer science, I must say. All right, I got a song here from Flogging Molly, which I've played on the show before. This is a tune of theirs called Tobacco Island. They're not necessarily a pirate sort of band, but this song is very leaning toward the pirate genre. Here's Tobacco Island by Flogging Molly.
What the hell, we must sail for the shore, sweet Barbados, where the sugar cane grows taller than the god we once believed in. The butcher and his crown raped the land we used to sleep in. Now tomorrow chimes of ghostly crimes that haunt Tobacco Island. Forgotten now for sure. They dragged us from our homeland, the musket and their gun. Cromwell and his round heads battered all we knew. Shackled hopes of freedom were nailed with stolen goods. Darkens the horizon, blackened from the sun. This rotten cage of Bridgetown is where I now belong. Out to hell we must sail for the shore, sweet Barbados, where the sugar cane grows taller than the god we once believed in. The butcher and his crown raped the land we used to sleep in. Now tomorrow chimes of ghostly crimes that haunt Tobacco Island. Red leg, down peg, blister burns the soul. The fog is there of plenty, but reasons there are none. Our backs belong to landlords, but branded is their name. Paid for with 10 shillings, cheap labor never breaks. The silver moon is shining, cools the copper blood. Where the living meet the dead, and together dance as one. Out to hell we must sail for the shore, sweet Barbados, where the sugar cane grows taller than the god we once believed in. The butcher and his crown raped the land we used to sleep in. Now tomorrow chimes and ghostly cries will haunt Tobacco Island.
Agony, will you cleanse this misery? For it's never again I'll breathe the air of home. From the sandy edge, the rolling sea breaks
That was Flogging Molly, and the song was Tobacco Island. That is one of my favorite bands, I gotta say. Those guys, everything they do is great. All right, continuing the awesome computer science news, I got another story here about more processing stuff. It seems researchers at Cornell have taken a good step towards bringing us quantum computers. First, a bit about that. You may have heard about quantum computers recently. They show up in the news every once in a while. Quantum computers process information using quantum bits or qubits, which are represented by the state of a single atomic particle or photon of light. If a true quantum computer could be created, it would dramatically increase, and I'm talking major orders of magnitude speed increase. The efficiency and speed, as I just said, of computer processing. Crazy things could be possible, such as figuring out the answers to problems by trying multiple solutions simultaneously instead of one at a time, as current computers do. Although multi-core processors are helping with that. This is because of the qubits, which can be in more than one state at the same time, thanks to quantum physics. As opposed to the currently used regular bits, which can only be a 0 or a 1. Qubits can be either a 0 or a 1 at the exact same time. Now, no quantum computers currently exist, even though you might read a story every once in a while about someone who's made some massive breakthrough, but it's still really, really in the early stages. There are a lot of things to figure out. But this group at Cornell, it looks like they've made a pretty good step here. Let's see, on to the research. One problem with getting quantum computing working is that it is very difficult to measure one or a bunch of photons or atomic particles without disturbing them in the process, which would mean you'd lose the data that they were holding. These researchers at Cornell have apparently come up with a way to measure a group of photons without disturbing them. Alex Gaeta, a professor and director of applied and engineering physics at Cornell, said, and I quote, "Ideally, what people want is to be able to measure the presence of a single photon without destroying it." End quote. The details of how they did it are complicated, but in essence, it has to do with a new type of optical fiber and the way they managed to get light to refract through a specific type of gas inside the fiber. They could then measure the photons that had their direction changed by the refraction without messing up the photons in the process. I hope this type of research gets a lot more attention in the coming years. Quantum computers will probably be the biggest single step in processing power since the advent of the transistor, but there are huge hurdles, like I said before, to figure out before they can be viable. This includes everything from just figuring out how to read qubits in the first place without destroying them, as this research was looking at, but also getting them to do things like switch, which is what bits do these days inside of computers. Go to zero, go to one, read whether it's a zero, read whether it's a one, and things like that. I hope I'm still alive to see this stuff when it actually does get figured out. At the rate things are moving, I'll bet we'll have within a decade some, maybe 20 years? I'll give that one 20 years before we have at least a basic quantum computer possibly working. And that's probably an optimistic look at it. Last week in astronomy news, NASA announced a successor already to the successful Curiosity mission on Mars. The new rover is slated to be launched in 2020 and will use the same basic body design as Curiosity in order to save money. However, it will be loaded with new scientific devices, even more advanced and suited to searching out any evidence of life on Mars, among other things as well. It will further a goal of not just going to Mars to look around, but also figuring out how to send rocks back to Earth, where they can be studied in far more detail. From what I've been reading and hearing, sending rocks from Mars back to Earth seems to be a pretty big goal at NASA right now, and probably other space agencies around the world. The new rover doesn't even have a name yet, but I'm sure we'll hear much more about it in the coming years. This is actually pretty cool news because thanks to using the body design, the same body design as Curiosity, which is already awesome, the money that they save will be able to be put more towards scientific research and all the amazing stuff that they put into the rover in the first place. It'll be cool. I'm still looking forward to more research from Curiosity. It's, I believe, going to run for another many months before it's finally done. Cool stuff. All right, with a musical theme about pirates, I have to play this next one. This is a selection of themes from the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, from the action parts to the slower parts, and ending with that main theme that I'm sure everybody knows. It's a journey. Enjoy.
Thank you.
All right, that was the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra performing the main themes from Pirates of the Caribbean, originally composed by Hans Zimmer, who's also done an incredible number of other movies. That end part there gets stuck in my head every time I hear it. And now maybe yours too. You're welcome. In skepticism news this week, anybody out there ever really think about that weird requirement to turn off not only your cell phone, but every electronic device when you're getting onto a plane? Why do we have that? The airlines make it seem like there's a huge safety risk or something along those lines if you have your phone on during takeoff and landing. But I've heard some good arguments that there can't be much of a risk at all. I mean, think about it. Does everyone on Air Force One turn off their cell phone, all their computers, and all the equipment as they're taking off and landing? Does someone tell the president to turn off his cell phone? I'd hate to be that guy. The Mythbusters actually looked at this one too, and they busted the myth. They stated that the shielding on the equipment is more than enough to block possible interference from cell phone communications. Shielding on the airline equipment, that is. Even with all this, officials have been silent on it, besides saying no cell phones on planes. That is, until last week, when the head of the FCC, that's the Federal Communications Commission, called on the FAA, that's the Federal Aviation Administration, to relax its rules regarding mobile device use during flights. So that's the FCC telling the FAA, leave it alone. Let people use cell phones on planes. Because of increased pressure from the outside, maybe even due to Mythbusters, one can only hope, the FAA actually started their own study to research mobile device use on planes back in August. However, they actually left out cell phone calling from a plane in their study. Which makes no sense whatsoever. The results of the 6-month study will be available sometime in 2013. If they start in August, they should be finishing up actually very soon. Why the FAA is so adamant about keeping cell phone use off of planes is beyond me. Maybe they don't want to admit they're wrong? When the head of the FCC itself says they should start relaxing their policies, something has to be up. We'll see what happens. I'm sure we still won't be able to use cell phones on planes during takeoff and landing in the near future, but maybe they'll actually look at the evidence instead of having a stupid plan. So, did you look up into the night sky last night? If you did, well, probably with binoculars or a telescope, you may have seen a bright dot zipping by. That was Toutatis, an asteroid with an estimated diameter of about 3 miles. And to compare, the diameter of the asteroid thought to be taking out the dinosaurs was about 6 miles across, twice as big. Last night, it made its close approach to the Earth, which it does every 4 years. Last night, it was about 18 times the distance from the Earth to the Moon away from us, which is pretty amazingly close when you're talking astronomical distances. In 2004, it came within 4 times the distance from the Earth to the Moon. Maybe some remember the news stories from back then. I actually remember that. With this close encounter every 4 years, Toutatis is listed as a potentially hazardous object. And that is the technical term, quote, potentially hazardous object. Even though it appears, the possibility of it hitting the Earth is very small. According to the orbital calculations made by astronomers, the likelihood that Toutatis will smash into the Earth in the next 600 years is essentially zero. Astronomers say that within a few million years, it will probably be flung out of the solar system completely due to interactions with the inner solar system's planets. Still, pretty cool. From what I gathered from the article, Toutatis actually also crosses the orbit of Mars as well. Not sure if it's every 4 years like with the Earth, but still pretty neat. I believe the biggest, it actually stays within the inner planets due to Jupiter. It must go around Jupiter and then come back around, go around the sun. So it probably goes between the sun and Jupiter. There is a picture online that I saw, but at this particular moment, I don't remember exactly what it looked like. I know it stayed within pretty close toward the sun. But we will see it every 4 years. If you missed it this time, pull out your telescopes 4 years from now, because it's going to go right by again, and also very close. Luckily, it's not going to hit us. If a 6 mile diameter asteroid could take out the entire dinosaurs, I'd say a 3 mile wide one, that could do some major damage. That's going to take out a city. Actually, that might even take out a few countries. That's pretty big. It's going to make a mark if it hits. But luckily, we've got physics to tell us that it will basically not hit us. At least nobody who's alive right now. All right, how about another pirate song? This one is from Jimmy Buffett. Someone at work mentioned this to me. The song I'm sure many have heard in the past. The song is called A Pirate Looks at 40.
Wanted to sail upon your waters since I was 3 feet tall. You've seen it all. You've seen it all. Watch the man who rode you switch from sails to steam, and in your belly you treasures you have ever seen. Most of them dream. Most of them dream. Yes, I am a pirate. 200 years too late. The cannons don't thunder. There's nothing to plunder. I'm an over 40 victim of fate. Arriving too late. Arriving too late. But I've done a bit of smuggling, and I've run my share of grass. I made enough money to buy Miami, but I pissed it away so fast. Never meant to last. Never meant to last. Just a few friends. Just a few friends. Occupational hazard be my occupation's just not around. I feel like I drown. Gonna hit up town. I feel like I drown. Gonna hit up town.
That was A Pirate Looks at 40 by good old Jimmy Buffett. I realize not so much about pirates, but hey, it's got the word in the name. Researchers at the London Museum of Natural History last week may have found what is the oldest known dinosaur to walk the earth so far. A fossil specimen that has been in the museum's collection for decades has finally been identified, and the result is that it most likely came from a dinosaur that lived 245 million years ago. This is 10 to 15 million years older than the previous record holder. Sorry, clear my throat there. Its name is Nyasasaurus parringtoni, which is made from the names of Africa's Lake Nyasa, now Lake Malawi, and the scientist who found it, Rex Parrington, who actually found it near that lake in the 1930s. Paul Barrett from the Natural History Museum, who worked on the study, which is published in the journal Biology Letters, said, and I quote, "It was a case of looking at the material with a fresh pair of eyes. This closes a gap in the fossil record, and it pushes back the existence of dinosaurs." So this being, end quote. So this being the oldest fossil yet dated, pushed back the entry of the dinosaurs on the Earth from 230 million years ago to about 245 million years ago. And obviously something had to come before this guy that was at least, because this one had to evolve into a dinosaur, into something that looks like a dinosaur in the first place. So it's definitely a little bit farther back than that. There are two features of this particular fossil that were used as evidence to say it was a dinosaur and not some other animal. And that is the anatomy of its upper arm bone and hips, which have features that are unique to dinosaurs. The animal was about the size of a Labrador dog and probably stood upright. The researchers are planning future work in Tanzania, where the fossil was originally found, to find more specimens and to build a better picture of the animal's anatomy. Here's a good news item, since a good friend of mine just had his first baby born, which was literally on Sunday. Congratulations, Steve. His new baby, Abigail, was born right on Sunday. A new system that uses ultrasound technology to look inside car engines and detect problems has been developed by researchers at the University of Sheffield in the UK. The results could lead to far more efficient engines and fuel savings by drivers. This marks the first time an ultrasound machine has been used to look inside an internal combustion engine. I'm not sure if it's the first time an ultrasound machine has been used to look inside anything but, like, a woman who's going to have a baby, but I think I've heard of it being used for other things before. But anyway, this is the first time it's been used to look inside of an engine. According to Rob Dwyer Joyce, professor of lubrication engineering, that's an interesting title, I quote, "There is a real urgency now to improve energy consumption in cars. Our method will allow engine manufacturers to adjust lubrication levels with confidence and ensure that they are using the optimum level for any particular engine, rather than over-lubricating to ensure engine safety. There is a lot at stake in getting the lubrication right." End quote. Car manufacturers have to get the amount of oil in their engines to just a right level. Not enough will increase wear on parts and possibly seize the engine. Well, too much is wasteful and just ends up burning in the engine, increasing emissions. Since cylinders are closed spaces, it's really difficult to see inside and test what's going on. Computer models don't work very well for when an engine runs faster and heats up. And cutting open a cylinder to see what's going on inside messes things up enough so that testing is not very accurate. So using an ultrasound device attached to the outside of the engine to see through the cylinder wall allows accurate measurements without needing to do anything that will mess up the engine. The researchers said that their new system can be used not just for car engines, but for anything up to the huge diesel engines, for example, used in submarines. Pretty neat research. There's thinking outside the box. Let's take this ultrasound machine and attach it to this car and see what happens. Not bad. I love it. I love new stuff like that. All right. Here's a song by The Real McKenzies, who I've also played on the show before. This song is called Barrett's Privateers, which they did not originally write. And I actually looked up this song because the lyrics are kind of cool. It was written in the 70s by a guy whose name I don't remember at the moment. It's kind of like a folk song. But it turns out that the song is actually very accurate. It talks about a ship in the 1780s or 1770s. And turns out it's very accurate to the time period. So it's a very, and it's a catchy song. I kind of like it. So here's Barrett's Privateers, The Real McKenzies version of the song.
Oh, the year was 1778. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. Well, a letter of mine came from the king to the scummiest vessel I'd ever seen. God damn them all. I was told we'd sail the seas for American gold. We'd fire no gun, shed no tear. Well, I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. All I'll quit Barrett, cried the town. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. For 20 brave men or fishermen who would make up for the Antelope's crew. God damn them all. I was told we'd sail the seas for American gold. We'd fire no gun, shed no tear. Well, I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. Now the Antelope, she was a sickening sight. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. She'd a list to the port and the sails in racks, and the cook and the scuppers with the shakes and the jags. God damn them all. I was told we'd sail the seas for American gold. We'd fire no gun, shed no tear. Well, I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. And on the king's birthday we sailed away. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. We were 97 days from Montego Bay. We were pumping like madmen all the way. God damn them all. I was told we'd sail the seas for American gold. We'd fire no gun, shed no tear. Well, I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. And on the 98th day we sailed again. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. With the big fat American hove in sight, our crack four pounders made to fight. God damn them all. I was told we'd sail the seas for American gold. We'd fire no gun, shed no tear. Well, I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. Well, that Yankee, she lay low with gold. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. She was big and fat and loose at the stays, and to catch her took us 3 whole days. God damn them all. I was told we'd sail the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Well, I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. What at last we stirred 2 cables away. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. Well, that crack 4 pounders made an awful din, but an American ball come staved us in. God damn them all. I was told we'd sail the seas for American gold. We'd fire no gun, shed no tear. Well, I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. Now the Antelope shook and she pitched on her side. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. Well, Barrett was smashed like a bowl of eggs, and the main track took off both my legs. God damn them all. I was told we'd sail the seas for American gold. We'd fire no gun, shed no tears. Well, I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. So here I lay in my 23rd year. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. Well, it's been 6 years since we sailed away, and I just made Halifax yesterday. God damn them all. I was told we'd sail the seas for American gold. We'd fire no gun, shed no tear. Well, I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. God damn them all. I was told we'd sail the seas for American gold. We'd fire no gun, shed no tear.
Well, I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, and you'll never find a better man far or near. I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier. Alas, a barrist, drive a tears.
That was the song Barrett's Privateers. That was the Real McKenzie's version. It sounds like a song that a band of pirates might actually sing on their ship. Pretty cool. And I looked it up. It was originally written and performed by the Canadian musician Stan Rogers. According to this article, it's full of many authentic details of privateering in the late 1700s. Pretty cool. I don't know why I like that song, but I just plain do. All right. Here's some really astounding news just released thanks to a new study recently published in the scientific journal PLOS-1. It turns out that mothers have actual cells from their children inside of their brains. When a fetus is inside a mother, various things such as nutrients and waste travel through the placenta. This has, of course, been known for a long time. However, regular cells also travel from the fetus to the mother, ending up in various parts of the mother's body, such as the lungs, thyroid muscle, liver, heart, kidneys, and even the skin. The impact of these cells, which are distinct from the mother's own cells, may have a pretty broad range of effects, going from tissue repair to cancer prevention to even actually creating problems such as immune disorders. One amazing thing here is that you and everyone around you most likely have cells from other people actually living inside you. The cells don't just get transferred, float around, and then die. They actually live on, sometimes for decades. This new study shows that not only are cells from a baby floating around in the bloodstream of a mother, but they also show up inside the mother's brain. The evidence for this is in the genes of these cells. That's how they can tell that the cells are from someone else. Mothers, obviously females, were found to have Y chromosomes in their brains, which can only come from males. What did the cells do in the mother is still fairly unknown. But there are some very interesting possibilities, according to the researchers. For example, these fetus cells are very similar to stem cells, which I talked about a bunch last week. It was shown in rats, which also exhibit fetus cell transfer, just like us humans, that the cells from the fetus actually made their way to the heart that had damaged tissues inside the mother, aiding in its repair. So a rat mother who had a baby growing inside of it had had some damaged heart cells, and the cells from the fetus went through the placenta, made their way to the heart, and the stem cells from the fetus actually changed into heart cells, helping to repair the mother's heart. Amazing. In another animal study, the fetal cells made their way to the mother's brain, becoming nerve cells. I wonder, does having a baby inside actually make a mother smarter? There have also been studies that suggest these fetal cells stimulate the mother's immune system in such a way as to help with preventing tumor formation, thus fighting cancer. This all completely makes sense to me, actually, in an evolutionary sense when I started to think about it. If a fetus is to survive to the point of birth, a mother needs to be in absolutely the best possible shape. A fetus's cells going into a mother to help with any problems that might come up, such as the damaged organ tissues or even a tumor, would increase the chances of a successful birth. So it makes complete evolutionary sense that this would be an adaptation that mammals have done. So, and again, this is not just humans where this happens. This also has been seen in rats. And I'm guessing this also happens in other mammals that have a similar growth period inside of a mother, as opposed to inside of an egg like chickens. All right, and with that happy story, this week's Unsound Methods comes to an end. Thank you so much for listening. I am Damon Blanchett, and you can listen to the show every Wednesday here on Yurt Radio from 5 to 6 p.m. And I know today is Hampshire's last day of classes for students, but I should still be here next week. I'm planning on it anyway. You can reach me via Twitter at Damon Blanchett, all one word, on Facebook, or by email at damonblah@gmail.com. I'm going to end it with another Alestorm song. I love these guys. This song is called Wolves of the Sea. Thanks once again for listening, and have a great week, everyone.
Doing. Late night in a perfect world from 11 p.m. to midnight.